Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Nothing quite says America is here than the profile of an aircraft carrier. But technologies under development around the world threaten to render carriers into sitting ducks. China, Russia, and Iran, all working on the so-called anti-access and aerial denial capabilities and missile systems aimed at neutralizing U.S. carriers. That's according to a new study by the Center for New American Security. For details, I spoke to principal author Kelly Saylor.
What we're seeing is a proliferation, first of all, of anti-access area denial capabilities. So things like advanced air defense systems, long-range anti-ship cruise and ballistic missiles, and submarines that are really increasingly threatening to U.S. aircraft carriers. And at the same time that we're seeing the proliferation of those systems horizontally in terms of having more countries having access to these types of capabilities, we're also seeing a vertical proliferation where we're seeing countries procure more and more of these systems. And that's concerning because not only are some of these A2AD capabilities increasing in range and precision, but because countries are procuring so many of them, they're really changing the way that A2AD capabilities could be deployed. So, for example, a country like China is procuring a large number of missiles, and those could be used to really overwhelm U.S. defense systems and particularly constrain the operations of the carrier.
So they could swarm some type of asset against a carrier that would just be more than it could respond to with everybody on deck.
Yes, that's correct. I think in the event of a conflict, an adversary would be highly likely to use a large number of these systems because that would enable them to overwhelm U.S. defense systems. U.S. defense systems are quite good. They're very sophisticated, but they're not going to be able to handle a mass attack against the carrier.
Does this mitigate in favor of better defenses for carriers or finding something else besides the aircraft carrier for the future as a way to project power?
I think it could point to a number of solutions. There are technologies like railguns that could certainly improve carrier defense systems and help them to defend against a missile salvo. But as an alternative, I think we could see investments shift slightly at least to more unmanned systems that are capable of operating at longer ranges. So, for example, right now the carrier air wing is relatively limited in range, at least compared to historical standards. But there are systems like the Navy's X-47B technology demonstrator program that are capable of operating at much longer ranges than some of our manned systems. We could also see a shift to undersea assets that are going to be less vulnerable to these kinds of capabilities.
Because carriers are expensive, and they're expensive to maintain and operate as well as build, and we've got about 10 of them operating now, correct?
That's correct. They are extremely expensive assets. They're around $13 billion for the carrier itself, and that's not including the cost of the carrier air wing. Obviously, many of the assets that go on the carrier are very expensive in their own right. And so certainly that's going to be part of the calculus.
Plus, a carrier is in the middle of a big group of ships, so really the total value of it is much higher than the carrier itself. Maybe people are looking at the affordability of this as they're also looking at the defensiveness of it?
I think that's true, yes. I think in terms of vulnerability to some of these A2AD systems, particularly the long-range anti-ship missiles, the carrier is going to be the biggest target simply because it is the largest, and therefore it's going to be the easiest to hit. But some of the other surface vessels are certainly going to be vulnerable as well. And as you point out, the carrier doesn't operate on its own. So that is also contributing to the calculus.
We're speaking with Kelly Saylor, Associate Fellow at the Center for a New American Security. So the question is, why then are places like China deciding to invest in carriers of their own if it's becoming maybe a 20th century type of technology?
Part of the reason that they're interested in investing in carriers is because it is a prestige asset. It signals to the rest of the world that you have arrived on the scene and that you're operating a potent and respectable military. I think they're also interested simply in the same reason that the United States and other countries have carriers, which is that it is a significant power projection asset. If you're not involved in a conflict, it certainly is a demonstration of presence and of power, and I think that's something that's very attractive to them.
What's the best and most promising asset that the United States have that can counter this A2AD capability coming from the other side?
I think there are some interesting emerging technologies that could help contribute to U.S. defense systems. I think the most promising and certainly the closest to becoming operational is the railgun. And that's something that the U.S. Navy is working on. They are actually testing a prototype of that system currently. There are also some technologies like directed energy that are quite attractive, but significantly further behind in terms of development and potential to actually become operational at any point in the near future.
And a rail gun is what exactly?
So it's essentially going to use a very high-powered, high-speed projectile in order to shoot the projectile at an incoming target. So another thing that it does that I think is quite important to note is that it's going to significantly reduce the cost of defense. The cost of using a railgun per shot is substantially less than the cost of using a missile to defend the carrier. And so when you think of a potential strategy that an adversary might use in the event of a conflict, I think you're certainly looking at a massive salvo of missiles. And that is to destroy the carrier. Part of that could be used as part of a cost and position strategy where really the cost of an adversary anti-ship missile would be substantially lower than the cost of a U.S. interceptor. And so the strategy would be to try to get the United States to expend a large number of interceptors, to expend a large number of resources, and to try to achieve victory that way.
Now, a railgun fires something, I guess, 7 times the speed of sound, and just the impact itself will blow up something. You don't need ordnance on it. But the question is power. Electrical power aboard the ships, is that the limiting factor here to get this technology up and running?
That's certainly a very large factor, and that's really the biggest factor in terms of some of the emerging technologies that I've noted. That's also a huge factor with the directed energy defense.
These are all quite a ways off at this point.
I think we're much closer to seeing the railgun become operational, simply because it's a system that the Navy is already deploying and testing.
Kelly Saylor is Associate Fellow at the Center for A New American Security. Read the full report on carriers and share this interview with colleagues, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The 2017 budget request looks a lot like the 2016 one, maybe a little more so. The well-known and costly platforms are all in there, from the F-35 to modernizing the nuclear arsenal. Law professor Charles Tiefer has been watching these matters for decades. He joins me now with what he thinks are some of the big drivers of waste in the 2017 budget. Dr. Tiefer, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
You have an article in Forbes.com in which you list the top 10 drivers of what you're calling waste. And number one is the overseas contingency operation, yet there are overseas contingencies. So what gives?
Last year, this looked like it was going to be a giant slush fund because it's outside the budget limit. And this year, once again, it looks like it's going to be a slush fund because it's supposed to only have the money for wars and other overseas contingencies. But it's very convenient for the Defense Department and for Congress to slip in there regular old, what they call base budget, weapons buys. And the argument in the Congress is that some point out there was supposed to be the figure in the budget deal was supposed to be a ceiling, but the Armed Services Committees are prepared to treat it as a floor. So that they can spend, on top of everything that they were previously budgeted for, another $15 billion.
But what about the request by the administration? I mean, to some degree, they're party to all of this by proposing a certain level of budgeting when they sent the request to Congress earlier this month.
That's exactly right. They opened the door to the games to come by putting $8 billion that should have been in the base budget, in the ordinary weapons buys that should have been under the ceiling. They put $8 billion into the budget they sent up to Capitol Hill. And the Secretary of Defense added, you could see a little more than that happening along the way. So the door being open, it's a question we'll see month by month this year in Congress how much is piled on top of the previous ceiling.
And then you mentioned some of the well-known platforms, the F-35, that's kind of a perennial, and also the Global Hawk drone, and some of the aircraft carriers, about $11.5 trillion. Are those needed strategically, and the issue is that they should simply be brought under control, or do you feel that they're not needed?
Well, they themselves are by no means being brought into production efficiently. The F-35 has been criticized voluminously by the Governmental Accounting Office for all its flaws. For example, its software is not ready for use. We were supposed to level off, not go so high in how many we're buying, but more were tacked on by the Navy and the Marines. To bring the numbers up higher. And the carrier story is a scandal. The $11.5 billion for the previous carrier being finished only was kept legal, only was kept under what Congress had said was the absolute limit by pushing some $2 billion into what will be done on the carrier after it's delivered. You know, you have the picture that the carrier is already in the harbor, flying the flag. It's been delivered to the Navy, and you have the workers rowing out to it and still working on it. And there's a new carrier that's coming along that the Governmental Accounting Office has already said is similarly going to come in way over budget.
That's almost like a cruise ship launching, but they haven't got the sheets on the beds yet.
When you're talking about systems that could be, I don't know the specific, we can't know yet what the specific flaws in the next carrier are going to be. We just have the GAO's estimate. But it could be that their defenses, their vital defenses against the other side's ships will not be on the carrier when it's delivered.
We're speaking with Charles Tiefer, law professor at University of Baltimore, and we should also mention former deputy counsel for the House of Representatives. I want to talk about the nuclear remodernization of the triad, especially the missiles, which is a very big program, which the Pentagon itself says won't really be affordable, but yet we have to do it. What's your take on that?
Well, that's exactly right. The figures on what the modernization of the triad will eventually cost are enormous. In this year's budget, they're starting one of the new nuclear submarines that will cost $1.9 billion just this year. And they're starting the long-range strategic bomber costing $1.4 billion just this year. And they're also moving along the projects having to do with the land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles and on new designs for the warheads themselves, the nuclear weapons that are put on top of these different platforms. And those figures for this year are just, they're just the first installment. One total, which I think is a low estimate, is $700 to $750 billion for this reconstruction, in effect, of the old Cold War nuclear triad of bomber subs and missiles plus warheads.
But in a world where China, Pakistan, Russia, North Korea, so many other countries have nuclear weapons, Iran eventually, what else, what choices are there, do you think?
Well, we're never going to be able to afford $1 trillion for modernizing the triad. Inevitably, we're going to have to pick one of or more of the triad elements to not complete. We're going to stop it in the middle. We may waste a lot that we've put in. And so we're going to be forced in the end to choose anyway. And the fact is that compared to the old Soviet Union, where there was an argument it could overwhelm one, possibly two, of the triad, and North Korea is not going to knock off all. It's not going to knock off all our subs and all our missiles and all our bombers and all the new design warheads. It's a different kind of threat altogether. It's a tough one to meet. But that's not what the $1 trillion program is about. It's a resumption of the kind of Cold War that we had when we had the Soviet Union, an entirely different kind of adversary than we're facing today.
And the final one you mentioned is Guantanamo Bay, which would save $500 million. Would it be closed? And needless to say, Congress will not agree. Is that really a funding question or a philosophical question?
Well, I do put aside I know there's a clash between President Obama, who sees it as a bad symbol for America to the rest of the world, and his those debating with him who say that it shows our resolve about national security. Just look at the money, though. I'm just looking at it in terms of the money, putting it on the list with the other items. It does cost $450 million a year, and that's because at this point we are spending $5 million per detainee. I'm not sure what the multiple is, but it's something like 3 guards for every 1 detainee. Well, that's money we shouldn't be pouring down that hole. It was one thing when we had 800 detainees. Then you could understand paying a lot of money. If it was worth having them all as detainees, then you had to pay a lot of money. There's 91 detainees left. You really need to spend $450 million on 91 detainees?
Maybe they could put them to work outfitting the rest of the carriers. I don't know if they're innocent.
I think they're more sort of land and desert dwellers than Navy people, but you could use them on some project.
All right. Charles Tiefer is former House General Counsel, now a law professor at the University of Baltimore. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.